Welcome. You're listening to the South Harbor Church podcast. South Harbor is a part of the Harbor Churches, which exist to help people find their way back to God. This week, we're going to wrap up our series, Lesser Gods, with a message called The Idol of Comfort, which Pastor Rob is going to ask us to consider, which hard conversations do we need to step into? As always, be sure to stick around after the message for more information about how you can connect with the South Harbor Church community. And now, here's Pastor Rob.
My name is Rob. I'm one of the pastors here at South Harbor. If you're visiting with us, welcome. We're glad you're here. I'm glad you're here. It's another sunny fall day in West Michigan, and it's gorgeous, and we're thankful. Everybody comfortable? Yeah. We're about to change that. Here we go. So we have been talking, we've been in a message series the last couple of weeks talking about, it's called Lesser Gods, and we're talking about idols, the idols that we have in our lives. And so just a quick recap on some of those idols that we've talked about. One of them was the idol of instant gratification, right? We live in a world where we have gotten so used to getting what we want right away that we kind of get unreasonably angry if our Amazon purchase comes in 3 days instead of two, right? Right? Or if you accidentally order something from China and it takes like 3 weeks and you're like, ah! We want what we want and we want it now. And our culture feeds that. And that actually becomes an idol. It becomes a barrier to what God really wants in our lives. So that was one thing we talked about. And then last week we talked about the idol of self. And that's actually a pretty big one when we put ourselves kind of on the throne of our lives. Tim spoke last week and he talked about Samson. Remember Samson, when you were growing up, you were taught that he was like a hero of the faith. And we found out that Samson's actually kind of a messed up guy, right? That he puts himself at the center of his life so much that he actually misses the entire purpose of his life. God called him to lead his people. And when we got to the end of the story last week, he hadn't done anything except kind of feed his own appetites. And so that's the idol of self. And hopefully through this series, we're going to be challenged to see what kind of idols we have in our own lives, see the things that we have put, as we like to say, put on the throne of our own lives that maybe shouldn't be that thing, right? An idol can be a good thing. Our families can become an idol. Our work can become an idol. There's lots of things that are good things. But when they become the ultimate thing in our life, it actually sort of moves God off the throne and it supplants God. So hopefully we'll see some of those things in our lives so that we can do something about it. This week, we're going to be talking about the idol of comfort. And I got to be honest with you, when I saw the title of this, that this was the week I was going to be preaching, I was like, this is going to be awesome. Because if I know something, it's like, I love to be comfortable. Like, I know how to make myself comfortable, and I've got a lot to say on this topic. So, I don't have a lot of routines necessarily in my life, but one of my routines is that when I go home from work, whatever I'm wearing, this sweater or whatever it is, I'll take this off, and I have this kind of quilted sort of thick, fleecy, hooded sweatshirt that I put on. I wear this thing like 9 months of the year because we live in Michigan and it's cold most of the time. So I wear this thing all year long, and then I have this pair of Keen kind of slip-on clogs that I've had for, I think, 15 years, like way outlived their useful life. But these are things that when I put them on, it's like they're a part of my body, which is a little gross, but I'm so comfortable in them. So I put those things on, and I put these things on pretty much every day when I go home. And these are the things that I'm sure Shanna wants to throw away or burn or something like that. But they're so comfortable. And then I'll come down and I'll sit in a chair and I'll grab something to read or I'll watch TV. Maybe I'll put a fire in the fireplace. And that's kind of my happy place. I like that. I like being comfortable. But obviously, if that becomes the most important thing in my life, if making myself comfortable becomes like the end-all be-all of my life, then there's a lot of things that aren't going to happen, right? I'm going to pass up doing some of the things that I'm supposed to be doing. I'm going to miss out on opportunities to grow and to be a normal human because I'm too busy taking care of myself. So when I thought about comfort, I thought about all that stuff. And then I realized that we're not actually going to talk about that kind of comfort. We're going to talk about a kind of comfort that's even more uncomfortable to talk about. And I would define it as kind of a relational comfort. how we do relationships and our decisions to sort of put comfort above actual authentic relationships. I was recently having dinner with some friends, and we were having the conversation about the upcoming holidays. I can't believe we're where we're at already, but Thanksgiving is coming up this week. Actually, when Jared said December 1st next week, I was like, you've got to be kidding me. But we've got Thanksgiving coming up. And as we were talking about it, that conversation morphed into a conversation about family and family time together, because the holidays are a time where we generally gather, right? We get together with our more extended family. I know for me that this is probably the one time a year that there's an actual gathering that I'm invited to, that I'll have to drive to Chicago to see a lot of my aunts and uncles and cousins and stuff like that. So, but as we talked about it, we talked about how those can be really tense times, right? Some of those things, that's not necessarily good news. Gathering with family isn't always good news for us, is it? Because we get together, and then we remember some of the conflict, some of the pain, some of the hard conversations, the arguments, the all that stuff that we kind of have in our past. We remember all those things, and then when we show up, we don't deal with that, right? We don't go, hey, remember that argument we had years ago? Let's talk about that. Let's open that up right here at the dinner table. We don't do that, right? We even make kind of jokes about how there's a bunch of things you don't talk about at the dinner table on Thanksgiving, right? It's against the rules to talk about politics, religion. You can name those things. But we avoid those conversations, and we end up talking about, well, my family will end up talking about how bad the Bears are. Yours will probably talk about how bad the Lions are. It doesn't matter, but anything to just not talk about the real things, right? We'll talk about sports, we'll talk about what our kids are doing, and then after a while, we'll run out of things to say, and we'll sit there wondering, how long do I have to be here before it's, like, not rude to leave, right? Sometimes we have a backup plan, right? Just how do I get out of here? Somebody call me, tell me there's an emergency, and then I'll leave. But we almost never deal with what's really going on under the surface, because those conversations are uncomfortable, right? They're hard, they're painful. And we would rather just ignore it or pretend it doesn't exist. So today we're going to talk about a great story about conflict and avoiding conflict and putting our own comfort above authentic relationship. And we're going to go back to the book of Genesis, back at the beginning of the Bible. And we're going to talk again about one of the heroes of the Bible. I actually have heroes in air quotes in my notes, because as we're finding out when we talk about these people in the Bible, we're finding out that they're not actually heroes, right? They're just people. They're people, and they're broken people, and they're messed up people, and they're pretty self-focused most of the time, and still God somehow uses them in his story. So we're not talking about heroes, we're talking about people. We're talking about people like you and me that God chooses to use in his story in the world. And the part of the story that actually gets our focus is going to be in Genesis 33. But before we go there, I have to give you some backstory, because it's this amazing moment in the relationship between two brothers. But before we get there, we need to know what has happened before that. So we are going to be looking at the lives of Jacob and Esau. You guys may know these names. If you grew up in church, you'll know these names. Jacob and Esau were twin brothers. They were born to Isaac and Rebekah. You remember Isaac? Isaac is the son of Abraham. God made a covenant with Abraham. He said, if you follow my commands, I will make a great nation out of you. And then Abraham finally had Isaac. They were very old. He and his wife were very old. He didn't think they could have kids, but they did. They had Isaac. Isaac, then you might remember this story. God tells Abraham to take Isaac up the side of a mountain and sacrifice him. Tim told us about that story not too long back, and he told about how that was God's moment of saying, this is not the kind of God I am, and this is not the kind of people you are going to be. He was putting an end to a really horrific practice that was pretty common in the world. But I do wonder what that does to a boy when your dad takes you up the side of a mountain. Anyway, maybe that's why we see in this story that Isaac isn't, like, going to win Best Dad of the Year award. But anyway, Isaac grows up. Isaac marries Rebekah. They have twins, Jacob and Esau. So this all happens in, the boys are born in chapter 25 of Genesis. And if you read about Jacob and Esau, in my opinion, they're two of the most brotherish brothers, like in the Bible, right? Anybody here a brother? Are you a brother or have a brother? Anybody here have a younger brother? Yeah, you know what I'm talking about when I talk about brotherish brothers, right? Or maybe you have kids that are brothers and you see this in their lives. I have a younger brother. And when we were growing up, we were not the best of friends, believe it or not. We were very brotherish brothers. I would say our time was split between hanging out together, which was very, very little, fighting, which is most of the rest of the time, or not talking, which was the remainder, just ignoring each other. So if you have a brother, you'll understand. These two boys are totally different. They're born completely different. It says when Esau was born, he came out, his skin was red, and he was like covered in hair, which is terrifying. I have had three children, and I've been at all three of their births, and if one of them came out red and hairy, I would be really, really worried. But sorry, Esau, that's how he came out. That's what happened. And then we find out Jacob's not. Maybe he's fair-skinned. It doesn't say. It just doesn't say that he's red or hairy, so we assume that he's neither of these things. And they're born, and then Esau becomes the outdoorsman, right? He's the hunter. He's the fisherman. He's the one that's going to be tromping off in the woods or walking around in the open country. You'll hear that a lot in this passage. And Jacob is not like that at all. Jacob's quieter. Jacob, it says that he liked to hang out in the tent. He's an indoor guy. Esau is an outdoor guy. They don't really agree. And from day one, there's conflict. When they were born, Esau's born, and Jacob comes out clinging to his heel, like holding on, almost like, I want to be first. I'm going to try to pull you back in. I want to be first. And this is going to be like a pattern in their lives. As we see, as we read this story, we're going to see Jacob sort of always trying to sort of one up a little bit. And one of the most important things for a boy back in this time, especially the eldest son, was that if you're the eldest son, you receive the birthright. I never really knew what that was when I was a kid. I thought it was like a piece of paper. It's not a piece of paper. The birthright is you receive the inheritance and you receive the position of the father. So when dad dies, you get all the stuff and you're the leader of the family. So it's a really important thing to be the firstborn. And Esau has that. It's automatic. It doesn't matter that he was only seconds older than his brother. It automatically goes to Esau. That's an important thing to know as we get into this story. So listen to what happens when the boys are growing up a bit. This is right after their birth. This isn't right after the birth, but this passage comes right after their birth in the book. This is chapter 25, and we're going to look at verse 27. It says, the boys grew up, and Esau became a skillful hunter, a man of the open country, while Jacob was content to stay at home among the tents. Isaac, who had a taste for wild game, loved Esau, but Rebekah loved Jacob. Also, playing favorites with your kids, I don't recommend this. Doesn't turn out well. Once when Jacob was cooking stew, Esau came in from the open country, famished. And he said to Jacob, quick, let me have some of that red stew. I'm famished. And it says that is why he is also called Edom. That's a much longer story. Edom essentially means red. It's red stew. He came out red. There's a lot of red going on with Esau. Not for this sermon. I'll let Tim handle that. Anyway, he says, I'm famished. Jacob replies, first sell me your birthright. Look, I'm about to die, Esau said. What good is a birthright to me? But Jacob said, swear to me first. So he swore an oath to him, selling his birthright to Jacob. Then Jacob gave Esau some bread and some lentil stew. He ate and drank and then got up and left. A couple of things about this. First of all, a couple of the idols I mentioned earlier, do you guys see any of these at work here? What did Esau do? He came in and he was famished. He was hungry. He wasn't actually going to die. I think he's exaggerating here a little bit. If you have teenagers or remember being a teenager, you were never hungry. You were either not hungry or you were starving, right? I think that's what's going on here. He's coming in. He's been tromping out in the open country and he's really hungry. And so in the moment of that, he gives up inheritance and position of his family. It's crazy. But he wanted that stew so bad and he wanted it right now. So we see this instant gratification here. And what about Jacob? What's Jacob thinking right now? He's already got the food made. His brother comes in. His brother's hungry. They're part of the same family. Just give him the stew. But he sees an opportunity to get an edge. He sees an opportunity to put himself forward, to make himself more important. And so that idol of self is at work in Jacob in this moment. So we see these things working. Now, I have no idea. It doesn't say in Scripture that Isaac ever finds out about this, which I think is interesting. He doesn't know maybe that this deal's been struck, but it doesn't matter. He continues to favor Esau all the time, and we see this years later. Now, Isaac is weak and old, and he calls Esau to him, and this is in chapter 27. We're going to be jumping around a lot in Genesis, so just read it up there. It's probably easier. So in chapter 27, verse 2, Isaac says, "I am now an old man, and I don't know the day of my death. Now then, get your equipment, your quiver and bow, and go out to the open country to hunt some wild game for me. Prepare me the kind of tasty food I like and bring it to me to eat so that I may give you my blessing before I die." He still sees Esau as the firstborn son that's going to receive the blessing. What happens here is Esau, we're going to kind of paraphrase here the rest of it because it's a long passage. Esau goes out to hunt and bring the food back to his dad. Jacob and his mom conspire and they steal the blessing. She makes the food, and she helps him cover his arms with hair, with the skin of a goat, so that Isaac, who can no longer see, thinks he's blessing Esau. And they steal the blessing. And then Esau comes back. Esau comes back, and Isaac says, "Your brother has stolen you. I've already blessed your brother. I can't bless you." And it's a horrible scene. Esau weeps, and he begs with his dad, "Please, don't you even have one more blessing for me?" But Isaac has nothing to give to Esau. So verse 41 says this: Esau held a grudge against Jacob because of the blessing his father had given him. And he said to himself, "The days of mourning for my father are near. Then I will kill my brother Jacob." Pretty soon dad's going to die, and I'm going to kill that guy. And he's serious. So Jacob flees. He runs away. His mom says, go to this relative's house. And he does that. He leaves. And we're going to fast forward now a bunch of years. He hasn't seen his brother in a long, long time. And a lot of stuff has happened. He's gotten married to two wives. He's had a bunch of kids. He's worked a lot. And in his work and in his story, you'll see him being pretty deceptive. He's pretty shrewd. The kind of stuff he did with his brother, he keeps doing with other people. And so he makes some enemies, and he also makes himself very wealthy. Jacob ends up having 12 sons. 12. That's a lot of boys. And Jacob's got a lot of boys. And Jacob, who should know more than anybody else about the importance of a father's blessing, actually openly favors one of his boys. So can we imagine how that's going to go for his son, Joseph? Do you know Joseph's story? Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat, if you ever saw that a version of the story. But Joseph, because he is favored, is hated by his brothers, who then plot to kill him. And we keep seeing these things, right? These patterns are coming through. And we think about Isaac's experience, and we think about Jacob's experience, and we think about Joseph's experience. And maybe our families today aren't quite that dysfunctional, or maybe they are. But we can clearly see how the actions of one generation impact the next one, can't we? Can we see this sort of what we would call a generational sin, something that gets passed down and passed down and passed down? And if we don't take time in our world to look at those things in our lives, we're going to pass those things down to the next generation? That's getting a little ahead of ourselves. So let's get back to the passage. That's kind of the real focus of the message. It's years later. They haven't seen each other, and the brothers are set to reunite. And as you can imagine, Jacob is not really that excited about this. He's actually quite terrified. He knows Esau was really angry with him. He doesn't assume that anything's changed. He assumes that Jacob or Esau will still be angry with him and want to kill him. And so he makes a plan. And this is in chapter 2. This is the preparation for him to meet his brother Esau. It says that from what he had, he selected a gift for his brother Esau. And listen to this gift. Just think of the numbers and the amount of things that are happening here. 200 female goats and 20 male goats, 200 ewes and 20 rams, 30 female camels with their young, 40 cows and 10 bulls, and 20 female donkeys and 10 male donkeys. And he put them in the care of his servants, each herd by itself, and said to his servants, "Go ahead of me and keep some space between the herds." Jacob is afraid for his life, so he presents Esau with a kingly gift. This is a lot. It's a lot of money that he's basically giving him. And it says, "For he thought, I will pacify him with these gifts I am sending on ahead. Later, when I see him, perhaps he will receive me." So his intention may be to actually reconcile with his brother, but what does it really look like? Kind of looks like a bribe, right? It kind of looks like if I can just sort of butter him up, if I can just, I don't know, just the idea of pacifying, right? If I can just make him think that everything's good, then maybe he'll receive me. And then when he goes to meet Esau, he makes kind of a parade out of it. All his kids are there, all his wives are both there, all his servants, all of his stuff. And I wonder if a part of that isn't like, I want him to see, like, if he's going to kill me, like, what that's going to do. I don't know. I'm not sure. But here's them reuniting in chapter 33. This is a little bit of a longer passage, so hang with me. Jacob looked up, and there was Esau, coming with his 400 men. So he divided the children among Leah, Rachel, and the two female servants. He put the female servants and their children in front, Leah and her children next, and Rachel and Joseph in the rear. He himself went on ahead and bowed down to the ground 7 times as he approached his brother. But Esau ran to meet Jacob and embraced him. He threw his arms around his neck and kissed him. And they wept. Then Esau looked up and saw the women and children. "Who are these with you?" he asked. Jacob answered, "They are the children God has graciously given your servant." Then the female servants and their children approached and bowed down. Next, Leah and her children came and bowed down. And last of all came Joseph and Rachel, and they too bowed down. Esau asked, "What's the meaning of all these flocks and herds I met?" "To find favor in your eyes, my lord," he said. But Esau said, "I already have plenty, my brother. Keep what you have for yourself." "No, please," said Jacob, "if I have found favor in your eyes, accept this gift from me. For to see your face is like seeing the face of God now that you have received me favorably. Please accept the present that was brought to you, for God has been gracious to me, and I have all I need." And because Jacob insisted, Esau accepted it. Then Esau said, "Let's be on our way. I'll accompany you." But Jacob said to him, "My lord knows that the children are tender and that I must care for the ewes and cows that are nursing their young. If they are driven hard just one day, all the animals will die. So let my lord go on ahead of his servant while I move along slowly at the pace of the flocks and herds before me and the pace of the children until I come to my lord and see her." Esau said, "Then let me leave some of my men with you." "But why do that?" Jacob asked. "Just let me find favor in the eyes of my lord." So that day Esau started on his way back to Seir. Jacob, however, went to Succoth, where he built a place for himself and made shelters for his livestock. Isn't this a fascinating reunion between these two brothers? Esau, I don't know what his motives are, but he runs to his brother, he throws his arms around him, he kisses him, embraces him, and they weep. As if this is like a moment that's going to really change their relationship. But then that's not the outcome. Jacob still deceives Esau and goes to a different place. He avoids being with him. I don't know what Esau's real motives were. I don't know why he wanted to leave men behind. Maybe his motives weren't pure either. But what doesn't happen here is nobody says, "You know what? I'm really sorry. I'm really sorry what I did. I'm sorry that I broke our relationship." Nobody's honest in this at all. Why? I don't know. Maybe Jacob thinks Esau is like him. And if he were Esau, he would want to kill him still. So he's just going to project that onto Esau. Or maybe he's just not going to do the work of saying, "You know what? I'm sorry. I'm not going to, I know what I did. I know what I did wrong. I know why you want to kill me, but I'm not going to deal with that." That's the hardest part, right? For him, maybe, but also for us, is kind of owning our own stuff. When we talk about doing sort of self-work, it's like, what's my role in this? What's my responsibility in this? Because the barrier in their relationship, Jacob and Esau, it's not just the perception. It's based on real historical things that they did to one another. And that's true for us too. So Jacob decides it's easier to avoid the relationship altogether than to do the hard work or own his own culpability in it. So that's what he does. He stays comfortable. He hides behind his flocks and and gifts and his whole family. And then at first chance, he runs away again. And he goes and settles down on his own. He doesn't do the hard work of reconciliation that it's going to take to be in relationship with his brother. And he continues to do what's best for him. Now, next week, this week is Thanksgiving. It's already upon us. And for me, it is one of my favorite holidays. I think I have really fond memories of when I was a kid, when I didn't know what was going on maybe in my family or the kind of conflict that was going on. I was blissfully ignorant. But I do like getting together with family, but there is pain. There is conflict. There are old arguments that were never resolved. And we tend not to talk about those things. I think when I was growing up, I started to understand that we were really great at sweeping things under the rug. And there was a point in my life when I realized that that rug is probably a hill-shaped rug in our room, that we just walk over it. No one's ever going to look under that and see what's going on underneath. And years will go by, and we'll gather, and we'll talk about sports, and we'll talk about our kids. And then we'll go on our way, and we'll never deal with what's really going on. And we may never recognize the part that we have to play in that either. So we miss out on the kind of relationship that I think God intends for us to have. We never reconcile with our past because it's easier and it's more comfortable to just pretend that that stuff isn't there. But I don't think that that's what we're called to. In fact, I know it's not what we're called to. So Christ comes to reconcile us, right? Reconcile us to who? Reconcile us to God, yes, but reconcile us also to ourselves and to each other. Matthew 5, verses 23 and 24 say this. Therefore, if you are offering your gift at the altar, and there remember that your brother or sister has something against you, leave your gift there in front of the altar. First go and be reconciled to them, then come and offer your gift. God's saying that that relationship is actually more important than us putting a gift on the altar. But that sounds uncomfortable. And actually, following Jesus, pretty uncomfortable. Dealing with relational pain in our family, really, really comfortable. I told you at first when I heard this topic, I was really excited. And then when I realized what we were talking about, I got much less excited. And that's because I have a family too. I have a past too. And it makes me have conversations prior to this sermon about the work that I need to do in my own family. And it's there. It may require me to enter into a time of discomfort, some really uncomfortable conversations that need to happen so that relationships can be reconciled. Even if I'm not directly responsible for all of that pain, it's still really uncomfortable to address. One part of Jacob's story that we skipped over necessarily, well, skipped over until now anyway, right before he's going to meet Esau, he has a really interesting night. He's got everything set up, like all the gift is ready to go. Everybody knows how they're supposed to proceed to get to Esau. And then Jacob is alone, and he wrestles with a mysterious man. It's a really interesting passage. It's probably one of the most important parts of Jacob's story, so I hate to gloss over it, and let's talk about it now. He wrestles with a man, and he wrestles with him all night long. And the man won't relent, and Jacob won't relent. Jacob will not let the man go until the man blesses him. Finally, the man touches Jacob's hip and puts it out of its socket. And so Jacob is in pain, but he will not let go. And finally, the man says, "What's your name?" He says, "Jacob." And the man gives him a new name, gives him the name Israel. This is where the nation comes from. And Jacob leaves there with a blessing, but he also leaves with a limp. And that's an important thing, because we never are going to go through this kind of conflict without maybe having a little bit of pain. So he walks away, he faced the conflict, but it had a personal cost, didn't it? It cost him something. And I think that that's the only way that we can work our way out of this sort of cycle of destruction, self-destruction, I guess, in our families, that we have to let ourselves be uncomfortable so we can face the problems that are there. We have to embrace vulnerability. We have to risk the limp. We have to wrestle ourselves, wrestle God, and wrestle with what it means to be with each other, to be in relationship with each other. Maybe there's a relationship that needs mending that you have been avoiding. Maybe there's a conversation that you have been shying away from. Maybe there's a decision that needs to be made. Maybe Thanksgiving makes us anxious because family means discomfort. So have courage and wrestle through it. Courage may mean that you're going to feel some pain. Courage may mean that you're going to speak up for what's right. But face the discomfort. Lean into the challenge. Wrestle it to the ground until it blesses you. You might limp, but it's worth it. The way that this story, this part of the story ends for Jacob and Esau is very interesting. I want to just end with this. Jacob and Esau keep on living, raise their families, keep on doing their thing. Genesis 35 says this: Jacob came home to his father, Isaac, in Mamre near Kiriath Arba, that is Hebron, where Abraham and Isaac had stayed. Isaac lived 180 years. Then he breathed his last and died and was gathered to his people, old and full of years. And his sons, Esau and Jacob, buried him. Jacob and Esau buried their dad together. So at least for that time, in that moment, they were reconciled. They could be together. The story doesn't end with violence. The story ends with peacefully laying their dad to rest. They break the cycle at least for a moment. And that's kind of what we all want. To be reconciled, to break the cycle. And even if it means we might limp a little. Ask you guys to come on up, and I'm going to say a quick prayer. Lord, we know where we have broken relationships with family, with friends, with people in our lives, people that we work with. And we desire to be reconciled to them the way that you want us to be. And so give us courage. Give us courage to face the discomfort, the uncomfortable conversations, the hard words, whatever we're going to face. Give us courage to do that. Pray that we would go and be the gospel in the world and in our families where it may be the hardest. We pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.
As always, we want to say thanks for listening. For more information about the South Harbor community, you can look us up on the web at www.southharbor.org, or you can connect with us on Facebook and Instagram at South Harbor Church. If you're in the West Michigan area, we hold our Sunday services at 9 and 11 a.m., and it'd be great to see you. So until next time, we pray you have a blessed week.